I'm Josh Cohen.
I'm Alex Edwards.
I'm Corey Gergen.
I'm Eric Lewis, and this is Technically Pop.
That was so NPR.
I realized that just as I was saying it. I think it was just instinct took over. Anyway.
At this point in the semester, if we can drum up NPR level energy, I think we're doing well for ourselves.
Thank you.
We should be excited because we're going to talk movies today. We're doing kind of a mini season of Technically Pop this year, and we kind of did episodes based on what folks were interested in, and we wound up with three episodes that were built largely around TV shows. So we kind of wanted to take this week before the Oscars broadcast to talk movies. The movies that came out this year, the movies that we actually watched this year, and what kind of like big picture trends, we're sort of thinking about keeping our eye on and interested in. Right before we started recording, Alex, mentioned that she is not at all interested in the Oscars. Is that a fair paraphrase?
No, not necessarily. I said that I don't bother to see a lot of Oscar films.
Gotcha. Okay.
I guess I'm interested in like the, because we did our Oscar episode last year. And, right?
Last year.
When the fuck was that? And I'm interested in like the historical progression of the Oscars and like what the Oscars can tell us, like over the long term about film culture in the United States. But I don't go out of my way to like see any Oscar film in the year that it's nominated because mostly they're not for me.
Gotcha. Okay. But you do have thoughts on one. Like, the most Oscar-baity of the films this year. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I was actually just going to say, like, I say they're not for me, and I tried to watch, or I did. I watched one of the sort of, is it the one with the most nominations?
It is.
It's got 10.
10.
And this was a film I actually thought would be for me. It is, of course, David Fincher's Mank. And it turns out that it was, in fact, not only not for me, but it was potentially designed in a lab to be the least for me film that anyone has ever made in their lives. Like in the entire, you know, 160-year history of cinema. Cinema's only been around for 140 years. I can't do math in my head. It's cool. It's fine. Yeah, did you guys see this movie, Mank?
No, but...
That laugh! Oh.
At your suggestion, I chose not to watch it.
At your suggestion, I was actually considering watching it. I mean, so I messaged on the Slack yesterday, do I want to watch one of the good ones, or do I want to laugh at one of the bad ones? And Mank was at the top of that list. Either Mank or Hillbilly Elegy, and ultimately I decided to do some self-care and watch neither, but
that's a good choice.
That's a really good call. Josh, have you seen Mank?
I was also deterred by Alex's fierce antipathy and allocated my scarce time resources elsewhere. No, I haven't seen it.
This might be my proudest moment.
Well, I want to ask you to unpack this distinction between like why you thought it was for you and then why it wasn't for you.
Okay. So Mank is ostensibly the secret sort of hidden history of, is it which Mankiewicz brother is it? I don't even remember.
It's Mank.
It's just Mank. He's Mank.
Herman, right?
Is it Herman? Right, and then, yeah, okay. My, never mind, God. My sole real, like, encounter with the Mankiewiczes, other than, you know, like, watching probably a lot of films that they wrote, the original Mankiewicz brothers, is that one time in, like, 2011 or maybe 2012, I tweeted. Now, remember, 2011 or 2012, Twitter wasn't like a huge deal at the time. And I had been watching a lot of TCM while I worked on my master's thesis. And I tweeted about how hot I found Ben Minkowitz, who's like one of the hosts on TCM. And his brother replied to me and was like, I think he's creepy looking. Like, he was like roasting his own brother on my Twitter. And I was like, I don't like any of this. I don't want any of this to be happening to me. Anyways, so Citizen Kane, right? This, you know, the best movie. I mean, Citizen Kane is the best movie ever made in the way that, like, the Beatles are the best band that's ever existed, you know? Like, it's just an accepted, like, truthism that Citizen Kane is, like, the best film ever made. So Mank purports to tell the behind-the-scenes story of Herman Mankiewicz actually writing the screenplay for Citizen Kane, which he is in the film itself when it came out. I believe he was co-credited with Orson Welles. And this movie is kind of a story in which he really writes the script himself, and Orson Welles is like almost not involved at all. And through that, it's like an exploration of Mank's relationship with, is it Hearst? Good Lord, did I do any, like,
William Randolph Hearst
brushing up on my fucking research? No. Yes, so it's his, like, you know, relationship with William Randolph Hearst and with Marion Davies. And it's this kind of look at, well, I know what it's supposed to be, which is a look at, like, the writer as a kind of non-entity in Hollywood studio system filmmaking. So I was excited about that, right? Like, you guys know I research Hollywood studio system filmmaking. It's like one of the things I'm super interested in. I watch a lot of old movies. I really enjoy them. Like, if I'm going to sit down to watch, like, a comfort film, quote unquote, it's probably going to be, you know, Howard Hawks's Only Angels Have Wings from like 1940 something. Yeah. So I thought, it's my time. I thought, like, this film, this movie, you know, it's like, it'll be this, like, interesting, thorny, you know, like, contemporary exploration of the labor issues and all the kinds of different personal struggles that people bring to the project of writing a film. And, you know, Fincher, I'm a huge David Fincher fan. How do you guys feel about Fincher, like, in general?
He's great.
I'm generally pro. Yeah.
Yeah, he's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Generally in favor.
Great. Cool. I mean, like, Zodiac is one of my favorite movies.
Oh, stunning.
So good.
So great.
Yeah. Also,
That's the problem with this movie. There was no serial killer. Mank wasn't, in fact, a serial killer. Maybe that was the narrative flaw.
I was going to say that they needed to drop in Mark Ruffalo in a sort of Columbo-esque role.
Oh, for sure.
I think that would have made this better.
Let's send him these notes. Maybe he can do something in post with this.
I think he'd totally be willing to.
I think he should have set the movie on a prison planet populated only by men, and there's this weird related stuff going on. I think that would have made it really good.
I love when this whole show is just us pitching alternative versions of Mank.
That are just,
I'm open to that.
Based on other Fincher movies. Yeah, I love it. We have it. There's also a panic room in the basement.
I was going to say, Herman Mankiewicz
and Dwight
Yoakam
is outside.
is Dwight Yoakam the, like, predator?
He's one of the, it's, I'm going to,
I've never, I've never seen it, so I don't know. You don't understand, like, how deeply I love Dwight Yoakam.
It's, yes, it is. It's Dwight Yoakam. And yeah, I believe I could have this wrong. Cause like the bad guys on the outside of the panic room, like one of them, like, gets increasingly more evil as the movie goes on, and the other one becomes less. And I believe he's the creepier of the.
Oh, I love that
bad guys, but I could be wrong. He's very good in it, I will say.
He's great.
Yeah.
He's a wonderful punk country. Great.
He rules.
He does. What was I talking about?
Meg,
you asked us what we thought about Fincher. I don't remember other than that.
Great. Yes. So yeah, I'm a huge David Fincher fan. I love Zodiac. I have been fairly interested in Mindhunter. What were you going to say, Corey?
Oh, he was kind of purporting to do this movie in kind of an old Hollywood style, like it's black and white. So was there some kind of like a generational, like Orson Welles Fincher kind of thing happening? Like,
That's a
do
good
I have
question.
That wrong?
No, you don't. I mean, I'm not sure necessarily that he was trying to like stake a claim as like the new Orson Welles or anything like that, but he's known for being this like visual, like master artist, right? And he will CG like the smallest fucking detail in one shot just because it's not perfect the way that he wants it to be. And he has made these like, one of the things I think is so great about Zodiac is how pitch perfectly 70s it looks, right? It not just the costumes and the setting, but like the color palette and the lighting and the camera work and like the whole vibe is just really like period appropriate and interesting. And you know, truly like I think in that film, he works as a master visual stylist. So when they said, you know, oh, he's going to do this Mank movie and he's going to do it in the style of an old Hollywood film, like, you know, it's going to be black and white. Maybe it'll kind of look like Citizen Kane, or, you know, we're going to have that kind of, visual illusion going on. Illusion, like reference, not illusion. I guess that would work as well, though. I was so excited because I'm really into that. And then I sat down and watched the movie. This has all been such a long preamble to say I sat down and watched the movie and it infuriated me from like moment one. I think it looks like shit. It's ugly. It like makes the most bizarre choices. So here's a really, hold on, I have to clear my throat. I'm getting all upset about David Fincher's fall from grace. So here's like a really easy example, right? The film, which is about the process of screenwriting, that's the core sort of thematic or topic of the film. It has every sort of scene or jump in time or whatever, begins with this like typeface, scene header, like you would have in a script, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, like interior day, Manx, like little shack that he's in or whatever, where he's holed up writing the screenplay. And so you would think, well, no, you know what? I won't even say that. Let me ask it to you Socratically. If you were thinking about, if you're imagining these scene headers from an old, you know, classically formatted version of a screenplay, what technology do you think that those would be created with?
Typewriter adjacent? Yeah. I don't understand what you mean, like the text itself or the text in position on the film.
No, just the text itself.
Oh, just, it would be a typewriter.
Right. Yeah, yeah, okay. I see what you mean, yeah.
Okay, you would write a script on a typewriter, right? At some point you would do a type script, that's literally called a type script, right? Of your screenplay on a typewriter, yeah?
Yes.
And that's when we think about that Courier font, right? Which even like screenwriting, like digital screenwriting software uses now, that it's all this like, looking back at, it's a remediation, actually, to use Volter and Grusin. It's a remediation of this like typewriter font, because you used to like literally, you know, be typing your screenplay. when you type on an old typewriter and you hit the enter key, what happens?
So it, like the line moves up and then it shifts back to the left, right? Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So when these, typewritten scene headings appear on the screen in Mank, what direction do you think that they head?
I'm assuming not in the direction they should.
You're exactly right.
Based on context clues.
So, like, fucking moment one, I was like, what are you doing? A typewriter doesn't go down. It goes up. Like, that's the easiest fucking, like, visual metaphor on the planet. You know?
Yeah.
And so the whole film to me is like that. They shot it, I don't know if they shot it in color. I guess they must have, because Netflix, like, demands that you shoot everything in a full 4K pipeline, so that they're not ever, like, scaling up the image quality. They are only, like, scaling it down at some point if you're not on a 4K TV or have a 4K device to stream from. That 4K being resolution. But, so they shot in color, but they didn't do anything to make sure that when they made the film black and white, it would look correct. So they shot with these costumes and makeup that look correct in color, but that's not what things looked like when you shot in black and white in the classical Hollywood era.
Right.
You know, something that looks silver on screen in a black and white film is probably actually green. If you've ever seen, like, behind the scenes pictures of the Addams Family house from the old black and white TV show, it's super weirdly colored. Because you have to, like, do strange things with color in order to get the nitrate film to react properly. And make the visual that you want. Mank is, like, lit really poorly. It looks ugly. Orson Welles is a master of lighting, so if you're going to, like, make a film that's referencing his masterwork, you should probably, like, light it well, and they didn't. It's, like, there are scenes where it's just impossible to see what's happening. That's the sort of core of my, like, problem with the film, right, is that it's dog shit ugly, it would be, I think, the easiest thing in the world to actually, like, look back at something like Citizen Kane, see what they did, what the visual stylings were, and how they did them. You can't tell me that David Fincher doesn't have the resources to fucking go to the Ampus Museum and look up, like, production history and stuff on details on how they made Citizen Kane. And it's not in Academy ratio. It's in widescreen. Mm-hmm. So, you know, yet again, like, it just is a sloppy excuse for, like, a period piece that's supposed to be referencing something and instead is, like, flattening it and making it ugly.
It's so strange. That's so strange to me because, like you said earlier, that Citizen Kane is, like, the, like, go-to choice for, like, greatest film ever made. And one of the reasons that I've always heard that that is the case is that it, like, in some ways, like, maybe didn't create the visual language of film, but, like, kind of put a lot of things into place in a very clear way in terms of how you, like, set up a scene or a frame to, like, contribute to storytelling. And so it's, like, it's very influential in this kind of way. And, like, there's this, I don't remember which one, but, like, one of the creators of The Simpsons once said that, like, you could do a shot-for-shot remake of Citizen Kane just with, like, frames of The Simpsons that were ripping off, like, Orson Welles' visual storytelling.
I believe that.
Just, like, explicitly ripping it off, right? And so it seems, yeah, like, this is not, like, a lost piece of, regardless of what some people may tweet about Citizen Kane, like, this is not, like, a lost piece of, like, filmmaking technology, right?
Yeah.
So it just seems so weird that Fincher would just, like, lose all of that or, like, make no effort to do any of that.
Yeah, it was a increasingly bizarre series of choices, I felt, on, like, a formal level.
since you brought up aspect ratio, Alex, I'm tempted to ask, which of these two films would you consider more visually similar to Citizen Kane? Mank or the black and white Snyder cut? It's in a 4:3 ratio.
You're right. It is in 4:3. Actually, you know what? My favorite little tidbit to come out of the Snyder cut being released, which I should say I haven't seen because I think that DC mostly makes superhero movies for fascists and bootlickers, and I'm just not interested. But my favorite like little tidbit to come out of it is when they interviewed Zack Snyder, and he was like, yeah, you know, I saw that movie First Cow, and I just can't get it out of my head because it's so beautiful. And then he was like, and my film is also in 4:3. They share a lot of the same DNA. I cut the Justice League and First Cow.
I love it.
And I was like, you know what? God fucking bless that man.
I that makes me want to watch the Snyder Cut more than anything else, actually, that quote.
It's a wonderful, wonderful artifact. I don't know that it's a great movie, but it's a wonderful artifact. This might get us to some of these other things in the categories too, though. So we've kind of implicitly raised this idea of the auteur or the, you know, that from Fincher to Snyder, maybe the self-imagined auteur, or whether that status is conferred or not. But honestly, it seems like mostly the movies we watched, we didn't gravitate to that, let's just say, in this pandemic season. So, you know, was this not the year for that type of filmmaking? Like, you know, some of this other stuff that I watched a number of these things. Nomadland, I thought was very good. I watched Sound of Metal, like some of these other movies that were nominated. But it seems like that just didn't resonate as much, at least with us. It may have resonated with other people. But some of the things that we did watch, of this list, I think had other things going on. So, like, that's a long way of saying we've talked a bit about sort of the technical failures or aspirations, right, of Mank or, you know, other movies like the Snyder Cut. When you look at this list of nominees, whether for Best Picture or the acting nominees or performances and stuff like that, this group has been lauded for other things besides the sort of, obviously the technical craft is always there with the Oscars conversation, but this group has sort of been lauded as like its diversity, you know, two women directors nominated for the first time. You know,
I think this is where we get into this like really sort of tricky aspect of this conversation, right? Because I know this is not like what you meant to do, Josh. I know this isn't sort of what your intention was in posing the question, but it does speak to the way that we tend to think about film as either the project of an auteur or the project of someone who doesn't fit the auteurist model and therefore can't be an auteur. So when we say auteur, we frequently, like what we mean is a controlling and overbearing white man with a really specific creative vision that he imposes upon his work and the work of the hundreds of other people who are helping him to make a film, right? Or making a film at his direction, literally. And so, I mean, I haven't seen any of the other Best Picture nominees, for the reason I said above. but I'm like hesitant to say that this is not a slate of auteur films just because I don't think it's fair to like take the possibility away.
I see what you mean. Yeah, I mean, let me be clear. By any standard definition, Chloe Zhao is absolutely an auteur. I mean,
oh, for sure.
She's nominated not only for directing, but also for writing and editing her own film. That's an extremely rare feat. Although it certainly wasn't Oscar nominated, the whole Snyder Cut concept, I mean, he was doing a lot of this stuff from his home and like, I don't know, doing a bunch of weird stuff in post to get these things the way that he wanted. Now, that sort of erases, like you said, the bazillion people who work on any film, the people who do the CGI, the people who do the lighting, all of the editing, right? It's a huge endeavor. But in the sense that there is a governing intelligence for a movie like Nomadland or a movie like The Snyder Cut or a movie like Mank, that seems to fit. And I'm perfectly happy saying that we should accord them that status, though it's definitely a problematic thing. It's not like you're a Renaissance painter and you just sit there and you paint the thing for many, many hours by yourself, well, right?
Even Renaissance painters didn't paint the thing by themselves.
Yeah, sure.
They had the whole workshops, right, of people working. And it is really interesting. The auteurist conversation is so loaded because it does tend to erase so many people's labor. Go ahead, Corey.
There's also like a generational thing happening here where, this is always the thing I wind up saying on this show and then like wanting to complicate it, but like Chloe Zhao's next film is a Marvel movie, right? And I feel like there's like a, like David Fincher, like Aliens 3 notwithstanding, Alien 3, notwithstanding, like he has been able to make the movies he wants to make without making like $200 million like franchise films for the most part, right? Like he makes Zodiac, he makes, and like, I don't know like how many directors whose first film was in the last decade who like get afforded that kind of lane. They wind up making Star Wars movies or Marvel movies or DC movies, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now they do. I mean, that system has gotten really good at like churning those people through the system.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm really interested in seeing what Chloe Zhao's Eternals look like. I think Nomadland is like a really beautiful film to look at and sort of interesting. But it is like, it seems like the path to a tourship is like in a much lower budget range than it was for Fincher 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, that has to do with like the funding model of films kind of in general. Yeah. There are no mid-budget movies that get made anymore. You're
right.
Either 200 million or you're 2 million.
Right.
And, you know, four people see your movie. It is interesting, though. I want to go back to Josh's point, because I think that it's a good one. I want to hear more about what you guys think of this. But this is one of those years of the Oscars. Like, it's a weird year, right? We don't always have sort of normal years of Hollywood filmmaking or American filmmaking. You know, this slate of nominees reminds me the most of the year that the writer's strike was going on. So there was no ceremony because there was no one who would cross the picket line in LA to write the Oscars. They just wouldn't, the live show, like you have to have writers for that. Couldn't hire them. And good for those fucking striking writers. That was one of my first like times where I got really excited about labor activism. I was a huge TV fan. Anyways, so that was the year that, like, all the movies that were nominated and won were, like, weirdo indie films. That was the year of Juno and a bunch of other – they're slipping my mind right now – but a lot of other sort of movies of that level. So it's interesting to me that, like, in a year where so few movies were coming out and business was so interrupted in Hollywood – and things were just so strange that's the kind of year then where we end up with like, oh, maybe like black actors are good.
Yeah. I mean, this is really interesting that, you know, in the past, like few years, there's been very few black nominees and it's been a source of consternation, you know, the Oscar So White hashtag and like all this kind of stuff. And then this year you've got Viola Davis and Andra Day up for Best Actress. You've got Chadwick Boseman, the late Chadwick Boseman, posthumously nominated for Best Actor, presumptive winner. Mm-hmm. You've got in supporting, you've got three black men: Daniel Kaluuya, Leslie Odom Jr., and Lakeith Stanfield. Mm-hmm. So you just have a huge, like, a ton of great performances, and I kind of wonder, is that partly like these movies were able to shine more because a lot of stuff wasn't released? is it the cumulative effect of the Academy very slowly changing by some of the social media pressure and inducting new members and things like that? Mm-hmm. Is it a combination? Is it just a quirk of the pandemic that, you know, these movies kind of happen to hit this year, and some of the other Oscar-y stuff got pushed to next year?
I think it's probably a combination of all of those things. Definitely, that, you know, it was easier to see these films because you're right, there's not. I'm trying to think about like who's nominated for Best Director. Like it's, you know, three people who are, I don't know Thomas Vinterberg, and I'll never see. Wait, no, I don't know what Another Round is. What's that movie?
It's a Danish film. It's about.
Great.
It's about a collection of middle-aged high school teachers who decide to maintain a blood alcohol level of 0.05. And it's a dramedy. It stars
Mads Mikkelsen, yeah.
Thank you. Yes. It's good, but that's what it is.
Interesting. Well, so yeah, I'm looking now at his Wikipedia, and he's like, you know, one of the Dogma 95 guys alongside Lars von Trier,
yes.
Thomas Vinterberg is. So you've essentially got four. I know this is not accurate, but I'm going to say it anyway. You've got four like newcomer / indie directors, and then you've got you know, an establishment figure like Fincher, who still is really kind of an outsider, sort of. In that he's not, you know, a Spielberg.
Just like Orson Welles.
He wishes. actually, no, I have no idea how David Fincher feels about Orson Welles. From what I understand, my partner gets really upset when I trash Mank because he just didn't think it was that bad, but I thought it was horrific. But he always makes the point that, you know, Mank was written by Fincher's father, and he, like, his father could never get it made. And so in a lot of ways, it's David Fincher, like, honoring his dad's work as a screenwriter. So I have no idea how Fincher actually feels about any of it, other than that he loves his dad. But, yeah, I just think we don't have, like... You know, like you said, I mean, the movies that are going to be made by the Spielbergs and the, I don't know, who else is a big fucking Oscar director?
Scorsese.
Yeah. Yeah, what's he doing now? Don't know. Anyways, he's resting after The Irishman.
He's
still watching The Irishman.
He's still
He's in the editing bay still.
And he's also not watching The Joker.
Right, that's right.
He's very busy not doing that. Yeah.
I mean, good for him.
he made Pretend It's a City, the Friendly Woods thing. On Netflix.
Oh, that's right.
He hung out with his friend and he filmed it just like everyone else is doing. That's every show on Netflix.
Yes. Right. He is gearing up for Killers of the Flower Moon.
Right.
Which is going to be a big Oscar play.
Yes, it is. So, yeah, I think we're going to Josh's question, I think next year it's going to swing wildly back around in the same way that Green Book followed Moonlight. I think that, yeah, ugh.
Yeah, we'll have a year of retrenchment, you're thinking.
I think we'll have a year of retrenchment, not only of, like, great white men, but just of, like, really bland and mediocre Oscar-pushy whiteness. Just a lot of whiteness is what I foresee.
I want to say also, you know, there's this really interesting, regardless of how we got here, it's really interesting that we got Judas and the Black Messiah, One Night in Miami, Da Five Bloods, although that wasn't necessarily, didn't get quite the nominations that maybe it was hoping for. And then Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, where there are all these performances by larger than life people, you know, Viola Davis, Delroy Lindo in The Five Bloods, of course, another Chadwick Boseman posthumous performance.
Mm-hmm.
He has the nominated performance in Ma Rainey. Leslie Odom Jr., although he's the only one who gets a nomination for One Night in Miami. I actually think the other performances are as good or better. But he kind of sneaks into the supporting character and then or supporting actor category. And then you've got both Daniel Kaluuya, who's phenomenal as Fred Hampton in Judas and the Black Messiah, and then Lakeith Stanfield, who's really good as well as Bill O'Neill. And it's just really interesting to me that however we got here, it's really, really cool that all of these stories give us this breadth of, I mean, they're all largely historical, but they give us this breadth of perspective on Black culture that we normally don't get Oscar season, because usually it's an enslaved person, right? Usually it's a 12 Years a Slave scenario, mm-hmm. Or it's a biopic, right? It's Ray, you know, Ray Charles, Jamie Foxx playing Ray Charles. That's typically the precedent we get. And so one thing that is really cool is that, especially a movie like One Night in Miami, which the whole purpose of it is to show these four different perspectives on how do you resist white supremacy? Do you do it economically? Do you do it with violence? Do you do it in a film career? Do you do it in a music career? Do you do it by giving speeches? Do you do it through your religion and joining a group like the Nation of Islam? Do you do it by being a world champion boxer? So we have these different characters like Sam Cooke and Jim Brown and Cassius Clay and Malcolm X, and they all have totally different perspectives on what civil rights means and what is the best way to use their talent. And that is so important right now, you know, sitting here in 2021, where we're still daily thinking about policing and civil rights, and we're in the middle or towards the end, I guess, of the Chauvin trial. And all of this stuff is extremely relevant in thinking not only about the need for civil rights. Like a movie like Selma always reminds us, like, yes, like these were great heroes and, you know, the push for civil rights was historically important. But what I liked about Judas and the Black Messiah and One Night in Miami, and also to a lesser degree, Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and The Five Bloods, there will always be tactical disagreements and strategic disagreements about the best way to get there, right? And that's part of what the purpose of the Black Lives Matter movement is, advancing particular tactics and strategies around protest and resistance. And a more aggressive approach, right, of community engagement that you see in Judas and the Black Messiah with the Black Panthers, that's something that hasn't gotten its share in the limelight as much as, you know, as much as Dr. King, right? It's just, it hasn't been as palatable. So I was really heartened to see those movies get recognized, especially right now. And whether it's a quirk of the pandemic or not, we need more of those movies in our, like, film pantheon, in the zeitgeist, like, in the popular imagination to help us think through these type of issues that have not gone away at all. I mean, Fred Hampton, everything he's doing in that movie is happening right now. And Kaluuya does just as great a job as someone like David Oyelowo as King in portraying the charisma and the rhetorical brilliance and the passion. Although he is far too old to play Fred Hampton, and you lose the fact that Fred Hampton was so young when he was doing this stuff. That is probably the one problem with that. But in any case, the way that these Black historical figures are being brought to life, not so much in a traditional biopic, but in a little more narrow kind of, let's focus intensely on, in some cases, one night or, you know, just a couple of years in the life of a community. I thought that was really great. And I hope it's more of a precedent that we don't have as much of a retrenchment as maybe we need to brace for next year.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good point, and I appreciate you particularly articulating that often the stories of Black lives that make it to the Oscars are stories of slavery, right? And how very different this slate of films is. I think that's absolutely a crucial element. And I, you know, quirk of the pandemic, quirk of the sort of weirdness of this year in Hollywood or whatever it is, I don't think we would have this year of these being the Oscar films if it weren't for last summer's, you know, global protests against the police murder of Black people. And so in yeah. that way, it's like a, this is a really interesting, this Oscar slate. See, this is where I'm interested in the Oscars. It's like this Oscar slate says really interesting things about this historical moment, and what our kind of global concerns are as a film going culture.
Or film watching at home culture. Yeah.
You're right.
Yes. Yes.
Film going to my couch.
I just wanted to quickly note about One Night in Miami. I think another exciting element of that movie is the fact that it was directed by Regina King, right? And I feel like there is that idea of the actor turned director, and there is also the acknowledged fact that that is a career move that is often a lot more open to white male actors, and I think it's really exciting to mm-hmm. see her make that shift and for the movie to get rewards even if she herself was not individually.
Yeah, that's a great point, Eric. She's great. She's obviously coming off of incredible performance in Watchmen on HBO, and so yeah, to make that shift to being the director and advancing her own project. And it did get, Kent Powers did get a screenwriting nomination, right? And it's an adaptation of a play, much like Ma Rainey is an adaptation of an August Wilson play.
Yep.
Yes.
Yes.
They love August Wilson. That's a great point. I'm really excited for this to be her debut, and it to be so great is really cool. And obviously she knows a ton about filmmaking.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. I'm going to miss her if she leaves HBO television appearances behind. I mean, Watchmen, The Leftovers, like for years, she has been central to my TV watching. You brought up adapted screenplay, Josh. The one major Oscars thought I had when we talked about this episode is just where's the Emma Dot love? Like, where is Emma? Why is that not nominated for adapted screenplay? I see that it's nominated for best makeup and hairstyling, which mm-hmm. fair deserved, but really I just, this is returning again to a shocking amount of our content of the Bridgerton episode, but I love that movie so much. I mentioned that before we started recording that I had only seen three of the nominated films. I have seen one of them, Emma, I don't know how many times. I just think it's such a smart adaptation. The changes it makes to the story are just so smart and make it so much more fun. And the thing that stands out to me in particular about it, the thing that I particularly love, is that it is a movie that is very aware of how privileged and silly its characters are in a way that is amazing. Like, there are just constant shots of the servants looking on judgingly or sort of like giving each other a look, judging what is happening in front of them. And it just makes Austin, I think, so much more accessible and so much more fun. And I thought that was brilliant to add this new element to the long established genre of the Austin film adaptation. And I was surprised it wasn't nominated for adapted screenplay.
I have two theories. Number one is that it came out in February of 2020, which was approximately 45 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And my other theory is that it's so much of what it's doing is interesting visually. Like, as you say, like all of these like largely dialogue-less shots of the servants, like this, you know, the set design and those kinds of things. And I wonder if just like people wouldn't immediately think screenplay is what, and I like all that stuff is in the screenplay. I understand that, but it's like not a showy screenplay, if that makes sense.
No, you're right. People always assume screenplay just means dialogue. I think that's true.
I'm not defending that. Yeah. Call, but I wonder if that's part of what's happening here.
I think you're right. And I think the fact that it came out in February contributes to my love of it. Just that's the last movie I saw in theaters. And I feel normally I see a few more Oscar movies than I saw this year. And I think a big difference is I like seeing movies in theaters. And when I'm watching the movie at home anyway, I really struggle to come around to, ooh, I want to watch this new movie. Even if I've seen that it's gotten really well reviewed, normally what I do at home is sort of fill in my back catalog, I guess. I watch older movies that I never got to see. And that's just what I view as more welcoming at home viewing. I just had a lot of trouble sitting down and watching a brand new film at home.
That gets us to sort of this big kind of experience we've all had this past year, maybe moving slightly away from the Oscar nominees. You know, what has it been like watching movies only virtually only at home, and what kind of things did we watch that maybe we wouldn't have normally watched at home, or we had to watch so we only watched them at home? I mean, what were your guys' experiences like? Erica said he's, you know, the comfort things, like things he knows are good. Is that did you guys, Corey and Alex, did you guys also watch stuff like on repeat, or did you watch things you wouldn't have watched because you had nothing to do because you were stuck at home?
Sorry, my cat has decided that it's a great time to play with the table that my mic is attached to. So if you're here,
do you want to sit out?
You care.
I can start to give your I'll start to give your cat a little bit of playtime. I don't think I watched a lot of things on repeat. I did rewatch a lot of things, and one thing that I did, and I may have done this whether or not the pandemic happened, but HBO Max launched during the pandemic, and one of the things that they had was the full Studio Ghibli collection on there, and so I went through that entire like filmography in order. Many of those films I had seen before, not all of them, obviously, and there's something about like, I don't know, like visiting those worlds and rewatching some of those films and watching those films for the first time that I found really comforting and moving. I also think like watching the arc of a director's career was weirdly, useful to me, at a time when time itself was like moving so strangely for me, like to like watch an arc of a creative life, or like even just like technology, over the course of a couple of decades. So yeah, that was a film viewing experience that I really enjoyed this year.
You know, I did something slightly similar in that I rewatched all of the Star Wars movies except for Solo. Get around to
what? Why you gotta hate on Solo?
No, I like Solo. I just didn't end up watching it. I do really like Solo. It is good. I'm not, I would have been a much better TV show, but, you know, we talked about Disney Plus on our last episode. We don't need to belabor the point, but I do like Solo. It would have been better on Disney Plus, but I ended up just watching I watched the Skywalker saga, for what it's worth. And Rogue One. I just watched all of them, and it was a similar thing, Corey. It was like, there was like an order and a structure to like watching a different one every night and moving through the familiar beats of these stories that I've seen many times, and also thinking about how the technology changed and like the writing changed. And it definitely, this was also early on, like last summer, and it felt like very comforting to have a trajectory like, oh, and then next week I'm going to watch whatever, you know? And
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I did something far closer to you, Corey. I also watched a ton of the Studio Ghibli movies. I watched all of Miyazaki. Now I'm making my way through Takahata. I watched a lot of Kurosawa, too, just because all of these things were up on HBO Max, many of which I'd never seen, but I'd always sort of had on my radar, but I wasn't going to go out and, you know, rent or purchase them on my own. So the fact that they were on streaming meant that finally I took the time to watch them. But yeah, I think partially just because it was during the pandemic that I got really into Blank Check. I got really into watching complete filmographies. I had never seen Happy Feet before. What better time than now? And I also, of course, rewatched the Mad Max movies, but I also filled in those random gaps.
I think I found myself watching a lot of, not whole filmographies, but definitely like pieces of filmographies in the past year as well. This is an interesting trend that I wasn't necessarily expecting to like discover amongst us. But yeah, I watched a lot of Kurosawa films early on. I watched a lot of Miyazaki films when they went up on HBO. I watched a lot of Jonathan Demme films. Basically, I just watched the things that Blank Check had been covering. Yeah. No, it's like, it's interesting to me that in a lot of ways, like, I've gone through different waves of what I'm capable of during the pandemic because it's gone on for so long. So, you know, when we first like went into quarantine, quote unquote, whatever little half-ass quarantine it is that the United States did, was when I sort of like, I was like, oh, well, I'm going to like snuggle in and watch every Kurosawa film. Like that's going to be my project and it's going to get me through. And then I put
these 3 weeks will be great.
Yeah, exactly. I put this, screenshot on here of my Letterboxd. I'm like fanatical about keeping up my Letterboxd account, and logging everything that I watch. And I pay for the like paid version so that I can get my stats. It's, I don't know, a stupid thing that I enjoy. But you can literally see in my 2020, like, that in January, I'm watching like a lot of films, in part because the semester wasn't happening yet. So I like had free time. And then even into like February, I'm still watching a lot of films. And then March, I'm watching some films. And then there's somewhere around like April. And then again in, I think June and July and August and September, maybe even into October, that I just like completely fell off, you know? And I just was like, I don't have the capacity, having been home now for, you know, 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, like my brain isn't working. Leave me alone.
Since you brought up the run sheet, Alex, I noted a question that you put down or a topic that you put down. Can we talk about whatever is going on with Anne Hathaway's career right now? Can we? Because I want to. I partially think it's this, like, what we might in future years refer to as the Stephen Knight era of her career.
Yes,
just
yes.
Like Serenity and Locked Down, which I always forget the name of. What do you think's going on with her career?
I put that note in there because I realized that like two of the only like new movies that I've seen in the past year were two new Anne Hathaway movies that went to streaming services directly, that were sort of universally reviled. And I found that to be really interesting. I think my answer for what is going on with her career right now is that she is a person who literally can't be not acting. I think she like just has to be working all of the time.
I think that's right.
The theater kid inside her will wither away and make her desperately unhappy. And so, you know, yeah, she made Locked Down, which like is an interesting cultural relic in that it's like one of the first movies to be made in the pandemic about the pandemic. And it's astonishingly bad.
So I, like you, Alex, or at least like you when you first told me about it, I could only watch the first half, but there were parts of that first, like, I hated it. But I think of movies that came out this year, that is the one I quote the most often. There are just so many ridiculous monologues in it. Like, I love, I can't say it enough times, love the moment when Anne Hathaway says, "I see concepts." what a movie.
One of those scenes was actually the one that did it for me, that I had to turn it off, which is when they are in the... She and Chiwetel Ejiofor are both in the garden, like their back garden, and they're facing opposite directions, and she's like closer to the camera and he's like up a level as though it were a stage, like stage blocking. And she's smoking and talking about what it used to feel like to ride on the back of his motorcycle. And she was like, "To be a rider, it was a sexual feeling." And I was like, "We are done. We're finished. I'm fucking turning this off." But really, really fascinatingly, right, the movie of hers that comes before that, actually, I don't know if The Witches maybe came out before Lockdown did or if it came out afterwards.
Oh, thank you. I had no idea what the other movie you were talking about was.
Well, that's actually not it, though.
Oh, okay. I thought we were going to talk Zemeckis, but go on.
No, because I didn't... I mean, you guys can talk Zemeckis. I didn't watch The Witches. Okay.
I've watched all of Zemeckis' films, and I have nothing to say about him. So go on.
Great. No, I was going to say the Dee Reese film, The Last Thing He Wanted, which came out in maybe February 2020, maybe early March 2020. But it was one of those things I watched kind of early on in the pandemic. Actually, now I'm going to look it up and see. Did you guys see this movie? It was a Netflix movie.
No.
I have never heard of it, but I see it got a 5% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah.
Whoa.
So this is the Netflix follow-up to Mudbound that Dee Reese directed, which I thought Mudbound was really interesting. I didn't think it was perfect, but I thought it was very interesting. It was a novel adaptation. This is a novel adaptation. It's definitely Joan Didion. I think it's a novel. I don't know. Totally remember. Research. I didn't bother to do it. People fucking hate this movie. And it's not great, but it's definitely not as bad as Locked Down. And it's not as bad as a lot of movies that people seem to love that I cannot get behind or understand. So, yeah, I don't know. I just was interested that this is sort of like where Anne Hathaway is right now. She's in this like flop era.
I will say that the problems with The Witches are not Anne Hathaway. Anne Hathaway is not the problem with Robert Zemeckis' Roald Dahl's The Witches.
Anne Hathaway is rarely the problem with any bad project that she's in, right?
Yeah.
Like, I haven't seen Serenity, but I know she's not the problem with Serenity.
Right.
And this isn't new. She's been in some bad movies before. I mean, she's a great, great actress. But like you said, I mean, this is crazy. She's got like 5 projects announced already. She had like 3 movies come out since the pandemic started. I mean... Mm-hmm. She's got like 4 things she did in 2019. I mean, she's just constantly churning stuff out. So obviously when you do that, you know, they're not all going to be hits.
Yeah.
That's true. Well, I really enjoyed The Last Thing He Wanted in a perverse way. And I thought about putting it on my 2020 best of list, like just to be chaotic, because it literally like has a 1.8 rating out of 5 stars. Excuse me, on Letterboxd. And the more that people hate it, the more that I want to like reclaim it and actually say like it might not be as bad as you think that it is. But I don't know. That could just be me being perverse.
No, I fully support you, but I think just in a shared perversity. Like when we were just talking about Serenity, when you said Anne Hathaway isn't the problem with it, I was like, are we agreed that there's a problem with Serenity?
Are we not agreed that there, wait, hold on. Wait.
No, we're agreed. We're agreed. I mean, like, I think that it's a very fascinating, exploration of the experience of being a video game character. I don't know. I've never even watched it. I just know what it's about. It's terrible, and I love it.
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, obviously this has been a really weird year for movies. I still think I've seen some things that I want to reclaim as good, like The Last Thing He Wanted. I've seen some things that I think were genuinely good, even though they like hit a lot different during the pandemic, like Palm Springs was a wild movie to have come out during the pandemic because it's
absolutely perfect timing.
So
it was
spoke to what we were like all going through in such a fascinating way. But I think it's genuinely like a great film.
Yes.
Were it really even good. Not. Like to be so timely. But yeah, it's a little weird to think like what is going to be coming up, what the next year of movies is going to look like. And is it going to like, I don't know. Will we get back to theaters? You guys are so into theaters. I'm not. So Corey and I saw Emma period together,
yes.
Right before lockdown started. And that was the last film that I saw in a theater. But previous to that, the film I'd seen, the penultimate film that I saw in a theater was Knives Out. And I almost got in a fight with a woman sitting behind me at the Landmark Midtown Art Cinema because she was just talking in full volume to her boyfriend.
Oh my God.
And I turned around in the middle of the film as it starts to do its like Hitchcockian twist. They were talking so much that I had to turn around and go, learn to fucking whisper. So like, I'm actually not excited to go back to theaters. I will go back to theaters eventually. But I'm not like dying for that experience again.
I'm recording this from a theater right now. I don't know what you guys. I'm just in the back of the, I will say I had the chance to go see Tenet in September in the like weird window. Like it was a really early showing, like nobody, like three people were there. And it was, despite the fact that you can't understand any of the dialogue, it was so extremely fun and great to be in a movie theater again and watch something that has, you know, this big epic scope. And I can't wait to be back in a movie theater, and I can't wait to, I'm going to go just every week, like no matter what's playing, like it is the 1940s and people just went like all the time. Although I do not relish the, what can only be a strange new theater etiquette where probably there will be people, some people will be masked and some people won't be. And, you know, it's going to be chaotic, I think, but I am excited to get back in the movie theater.
Actually, now that you say that, I think about the time when I was the most excited to go to the movies, and much like the 1940s, I was paying like 5 cents per film. And it was the summer that Movie Pass like happened,
mm-hmm. where yeah. like,
all the venture capitalists got together and funded us all to go to the movies for a little while, and we were just redistributing their wealth. So were that to be the case again, I think I would also be at the movies every week like Josh. But it's just so expensive now for me to like get into fights with people.
Yeah, I'm not looking forward to the expense, certainly. I'm just looking forward to watching movies with people again. I really enjoy the communal experience of watching a movie. I mean, whether it's a movie night or like a movie night hosted at home or going out to the theater, but just watching a movie alone is so different. And I find it's often a lot more difficult for me to focus on the movie. Because I'm just sitting there on my couch, and I know that's all I'm doing.
I don't miss the experience of the movie theater, but I do. I miss watching movies with people. I miss everyone's like people seeing a movie at roughly the same time and responding in real time and things like that. But yeah, I don't, I'm with you, Alex. I am suspicious of everyone sitting near me in a movie theater, often unfairly, but.
I can't remember the joke I was going to make. It was going to be great, but it's gone now.
I'm sorry. What I said was surely not as good as your joke.
It's all right. It's lost to the sands of time.
What, just as a way to go out, what are the movies that are coming up that might tempt us back into the movie theater? What are we looking forward to?
Well, I noticed that Eric and I wrote the same thing on the run sheet.
Yes. Yes. No, I was so excited when I saw that. You'll notice that mine is in all caps.
Exclamation point.
I have been waiting for the Green Knight since that trailer first dropped before the pandemic.
Yes. I will say that this is one that will tempt me to the theater because I want to see Dev Patel's gorgeous face that big.
I agree.
And it just looks visually like stunning. And I think that it's such a bold, like, deeply pagan move for A24 to put this out this summer, like, which, you know, particularly for a lot of communities of like youngish people who are, you know, getting vaccinated now or already vaccinated. There's a kind of feeling that the summer is going to be like, wild.
Yeah.
And so the idea of like putting out this movie that's based on this like really weirdly sexy but also gross like poem about the embodied encounter between paganism and Christianity at like a moment where everything is transitioning in these really fascinating ways. I just think it's really bold and it's really smart of A24 to do.
Yes.
Yeah, I just love A24. That movie looks amazing. I love Sir Gawain and the Green Knight. I cannot wait. I watched that trailer. I'm just like sitting in bed at night and I'm like, I want to look forward to something positive. I'm going to watch the Green Knight trailer again.
I had the opposite reaction. I was excited to see that someone wrote it down. That's what I would have written down if somebody hadn't already put it in the run sheet. It looks awesome. It's also probably as an adaptation, as you said, of a classic piece of poetry, like maybe one of the more likely films for us to do an episode on next year. Super excited about that one. I put down a movie that I like just kind of learned about existing this week, which is Jane Campion's next film. We mentioned Blank Check earlier. I was team Jane Campion in their March Madness bracket, in part because I wanted to cry with John Keats again. Her new film is called The Power of the Dog, and it is Benedict Cumberbatch and Jesse Plemons play brothers in Montana who are pitted against each other when one of them gets married to, I believe, Kirsten Dunst, who is the third lead of the film. I'm looking forward to Jane Campion's Montana and these three like smoldering together for a couple of hours.
So that's reuniting Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Plemons from that season of Fargo they were in together.
Well, it's also reuniting them from the fact that they're married and they like live together.
Well, sure.
They just went to work together.
It is convenient.
It is. No, I actually love their romance. It's very sweet.
It'll also nice to be, and I'm presuming here, it'll be nice to see Jesse Plemons not play a neo-Nazi. Which is like a thing that he does a lot. I don't know.
Yeah.
That's true. That's
he
true.
He plays the FBI guy in Judas and the Black Messiah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Hmm.
I find him fascinating in Game Night for that very reason, because he's playing a kind of creepy cop, but just a very like benignly, he's just a weird guy cop. Like he's not evil or anything.
Really wants some friends.
Yeah, exactly. It's just an interesting playing against type, I suppose.
They did him so dirty in Friday Night Lights. I will never forgive them for that storyline.
What, the season two storyline?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
What a horrific, just stupid choice to have made.
Yes. Yeah. One of my, he says one of my favorite jokes in all of TV, which is that he says that he is in a Christian death metal band named Crucifictorious.
Yes. Yes.
And I think about it like once a week. And laugh to myself.
That's so great. I'm actually now really excited for this movie, Corey, The Power of the Dog. I didn't realize that it was even happening. But given where Jane Campion has come from and like her sort of early slate of films that are very much about the kind of spaces of Australia that are very empty, and what that does to people, I think is really interesting then to see her take on Montana.
Yeah. And Top of the Lake does some of that kind of stuff too, but yeah, definitely.
I haven't been able to get into Top of the Lake because I can't take any more stories about lady murder.
Fair.
The murders of ladies.
Definitely.
Quite fair. The other movie on my list, which I assume will involve several murders, I don't know of whom, is the Candyman remake.
Yes, Nia Costa. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
Have you seen her first film? Little Woods? Is that what it's called? Little Woods, I think?
No, I haven't. It's been on my radar, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I haven't seen it yet either, and I really want to. I'm excited.
I primarily know her through podcast appearances and love her, but go on, Alex.
Oh, I just was going to say I'm really excited because I love the first two Candyman movies in very different ways. where, like, I think the first one is genuinely, like, kind of brilliant, and then I think the second one is like so bad that it's just amazing.
I love the first one. I've never seen the second, but
oh my god, you haven't?
With that recommendation, I will.
no, hold on. I have to look up and remember. I can't remember who directed it because there's a reason that I watched it. It's called, for one thing, it's called Candyman, Farewell to the Flesh.
It's directed by Bill Condon?
Yes. Who did, he did those incredible, incredible late Twilight films. No, is nobody with me on this? Okay. If you have not seen Twilight Breaking Dawn Parts 1 and 2, you are deeply missing out. On an incredible, speaking of films I saw in theaters, incredible cinema going experience.
Right up there with Citizen Kane.
Yes, absolutely. Candyman Farewell to the Flesh is basically just the first movie all over again, but it's set in New Orleans for no reason at all. It's
okay.
The 90s were really obsessed with New Orleans. This is maybe a podcast for another time, but
well, I think that the new Candyman is also like high on the list of things we might do next year for sure.
That's probably true. Yeah. Oh my God. We could watch all three of the originals.
We could do the full trilogy. Yeah.
All right, cool. Well, now we have a plan for this upcoming year.
I love it.
I'm so excited.
Any other movies we're looking forward to or?
Well, I'm excited for all the big franchise stuff. I know that's not very interesting, but we mentioned, you know, Chloe Zhao's Eternals, this Marvel movie with like really interesting people like Brian Tyree Henry and Kumail Nanjiani and I think Angelina Jolie's in it, some other people. Dune, which got pushed back, I'm excited for. All this stuff that is going to just be great popcorn, you know, action, big action movies. The Bond movie.
I am excited as well to see these big, like, tentpole franchise action films, and I hope that at least some of them turn out to be good. I'm excited to see the Black Widow movie that has never come out. And I'm really hoping that any one of them is better than Godzilla vs. Kong, which I did not care for in any way.
I'm really excited about the Bond movie.
I
hope that it's a return to form after Spectre. And I'm excited about Phoebe Waller-Bridge's involvement.
Oh, for sure.
I think that'll be fun.
Yeah, yes.
100%.
Yeah, yeah, it'll be good to see Daniel Craig's last run too, presumably, now that he's made $100 million from two sequels to Knives Out, right?
His last Bond movie, the third time that it was his last.
Right. Yeah. Fair enough, fair enough. Never say never again. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, you guys, movies, like, they're good.
They're good.
We look forward to them.
Yes. Thank you for listening, and thank you all for talking about this with me.
Yeah, thanks.